Yo, 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 what up? It's your boy Colby Mack, and this is the Colby Told Me Podcast. Yo, whenever I want to deep dive with the Mack himself, where I get to amplify my movie reviews for your listening pleasure. Would you please consider giving your boy a follow? I'm on all the socials at Colby Told Me on Twitter and Instagram. And sometimes I'm on Facebook at Colby Mack. Welcome, welcome, welcome back. This is episode 14. Apologies for the mini hiatus. I was enjoying a much needed vacay with the mini Mac, and life's been lifing. And when things come at you that you're not prepared for, do like Paul Atreides would do and go to the other side. Yo, here's your spoiler-filled review of Dune Part 2. Paul Atreides unites with Chani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. Dune Part 2 picks up right where Dune Part 1 left off, and I tried my best to give that a rewatch, but I was on vacation and I tried to watch it with the Mini Mac and she wasn't feeling it. And I can kind of understand why. Dense material aside, I don't know how endearing this film is for a younger audience, and that's okay. Not everything needs to be popcorn and bubblegum. I enjoyed the film experience of Dune Part 1, but I also did say that it was like essentially the greatest trailer ever made to a movie that should actually be complete. And I think that Dune Part 2 is probably the second most impressive feature-length movie trailer to a movie yet to come. It did it again, but I'm not wholly mad at it. It just left me wanting more, you know? I will say this, Denis Villeneuve, he's on some master level work with delivering imagery and like creating the film language to stuff that I've never seen or experienced before on the big screen. And that can't be taken away. The way that this movie looks is awe-inspiring. It's transfixing. It's transformative. It's all the superlatives. It's that good. The production design, the world, this feels tactile, lived in. The sand, I felt like I could, you know, feel it inside of my big old Dolby seat. This is visual splendor. You know, the costuming, like the armor, the choices, the design, like the imagination and the execution of those craft elements are phenomenal. Like, this is the future of filmmaking. And to be honest with you, this sets the bar. If I'm giving you $200 million, it better look at least close to that. We can't be doing no $200 million Red Notice on Netflix and everything looks like it's built with inside of an AI CG model developer. Like, no, this world, Arrakis, looked incredible. This is one particular scene where the Harkonnens are descending down and trying to find, you know, remnants of the Fremen and possibly even Paul Atreides himself, because it's not confirmed if he's dead or alive. And there's this one scene when a worm gets called where the Harkonnen soldiers start hovering up a mountain, and the scope and scale, it just looked so massive to feel dwarfed in that moment, and this being caught on camera. It was fantastic. Equally as fantastic is the score. I mean, what Hans Zimmer does between the first film and this film, it's phenomenal. The cinematography is truly captivating and it's wondrous. It awakens your imagination of the things that can be do and can be captured on the big screen. I would love to say the editing would do the same, but I don't know what happened. It was skipping around a lot, especially at the end of the second act and the remainder of the movie. Dune Part 2 definitely, it was playing skip. Like, hey, we got to get these characters here. It's like, it was a lot, but that's like a small quibble outside of character and story. That's a tough quibble to kind of get over. I mean, principally, this movie's about Paul Atreides, played by Timothée Chalamet. And I, going into the first film, have not been too enamored with Timothée. Like, he's a talented young actor. However, I don't think that he's got the charisma or presence that captivates me, but he does it for some people. And particularly his performance married to a character who I think is interestingly written. So he's not the hero, There's things that happen at the beginning of this film and at the end of this film, and I don't want to rely on the source material to try to fill in the gaps. I think that that is the, that's left at the ledger of the director to be able to check off. Now, Frank Herbert's book came first, and we got to be for real. Like, the source material breathed inspiration to so many different stories that we got a chance to see and experience in other different forms of media. So it does feel like that this story or this journey is derivative. It's not necessarily the hero's journey like we've seen on the big screen for decades. It is subverting some things, but I don't feel that what we got in this film did a successful job at trying to paint the picture of what truly is Paul's goal, especially by film's end. And particularly, Paul is just not that compelling of a written character. We've seen the reluctant hero story trope so many times, and there's nothing in particular that makes this Paul stand out. Homie ain't got no riz, no snark, just height. My boy is tall, dark, skinny, and handsome, and that gets you far 8,000 years into the future. You know, but like, and it made it hard to even buy the love story and connection between he and Chani. It felt so contrived. It's like, we knew we have to make sure the Timothy Chalamet ends up with Zendaya, but I wasn't along the journey of what connective tissue really brings them together. And Chani has agency of her own. I like the command of what Zendaya is doing on screen. I don't necessarily understand fully her motivations for why she sees Paul in a very particular way. She's a woman that is committed to the cause and loves her people, loves her planet, chooses to love this man, but is resistant to him being anything more than that. But I needed more than that as to why. And I would like that explored through dialogue, but yo, Denise said what he said. He can't take it back. His interest isn't in dialogue, and I think that that shows. Zendaya is still a strong performer. There's still some great sequences of them coming together. And I guess it was hard for me not to see Neytiri from James Cameron's Avatar as a part of this journey. And what Zoe Saldana brought to her, all in motion capture, that was truly phenomenal work. I don't think that Chani, written or performed, is on that level. And I love the organic buddying between Neytiri and Jake Sully that I felt a part of, essentially an avatar unto myself to be able to get ingratiated with the Fremen, because that's where Paul and Jessica were left off with. Everything seems like it came too easy to Paul. And I didn't quite understand why. We're just told he's special, but we never get to see why he's special. And people try to make these, I don't want to say excuses, they give their opinions. Oh, well, he does the sandworm thing. My homie just does it. Like, he's never seen a sandworm, but like once, and then he could just get on it. Is that special or just convenient plot devices? I don't know. It just wasn't enough for me, for real, for real. But I still enjoyed what I had. This is not a bad film in any way, but damn, did I want so much more. I want to understand truly the buy-in and motivations on screen as opposed to trying to rely on other contemporaries in my industry or the book to fill in the gaps. Everybody was looking forward to Fade Rotha, Fade Rotha. I really need to try to work on his, it's better than the Elvis voice. I'll tell you that. It's way better than the Elvis voice. But yeah, okay, so this is the thing. Austin Butler did the damn thing because Fade Rotha, it's such a dynamic and interesting character design, and he is such a compelling former unto himself that with the two together, it made it so magnetic where you did not want to take your eyes off the screen whenever Fade was on it. But he could also be the Messiah too. So it's very thin as to the machinations of the Bene Gesserit. Are they or are they not the good guys or good gals? The Harkonnens, the Emperor, the Atreides, it's a lot. But just focusing on Fade, is he the dyad in the Force? I wanted so much more of him, though. Like, Butler's interpretation, with the help of Denise, just fantastic design, the performance. The voice was an interesting choice, but I'll let that go. And the way that he bitched out his big brother so hard, and speaking of bitch, Beast Rabbit, Yo, Dave Bautista really went on one. He thought he was really doing it. He said, yo, he was doing all this yapping. And you sure did think you was eating, brother. But nah, you was just yelling all movie long. No range, no dimensions. I mean, some decent work in the eyes. But bruh, come on. Like, this isn't getting you like Oscar shortlisted. It's sorry. You weren't giving anything more than just like kind of like this infantile anger. You were fodder and you weren't imposing. And the buildup between the rematch, I guess, kind of, sort of, between himself and Josh Brolin's gurney, it was fumbled and ultimately anticlimactic. Kind of anticlimactic, like the Baron. Stellan Skarsgård, I think that he is an enigmatic performer, and I love his commitment to want to do the practical effects, and I believe that that helps him truly become who he's asked to become. And Baron Harkonnen, it's such a great design, and it really is like the interpretation from Stellan was great, but it felt like it didn't amount to much. Between two films, I've got a handful of scenes, and that's it. Like, I thought he was supposed to be, it's so hard to like not compare it, but like, I thought he was supposed to be kind of like Emperor Palpatine in a sense, right? Like, Fade Roth is kind of like a Dark Vader, or kind of like a Kylo Ren, and like, the Baron is kind of like the Emperor. And I thought that we would be getting so much more. And he comes and goes, and it felt deflating. There was no pun intended at that because of the Baron size, I promise. But maybe he wasn't the Emperor at all. He was more like Snoke. And the choice of the Emperor in this film was an interesting one. Christopher Walken, okay, putting the casting, probably the worst casting in the film aside, the Emperor's written so thin. You barely hear about the Emperor in the first film, but essentially it's his decision that essentially initiates the entirety of one house versus another. And ultimately, in the end, it's because I thought your dad led with his heart too much, but we never actually see that being a thing. And people try to convince themselves that Oscar Isaac, what he brings to Duke Leto was fantastic, in my opinion. It sucks that it was so short-lived. But ultimately, like, that, there was not enough to see on screen as to why the Emperor felt, you know, the Atreides house was a threat. Like, the Harkonnens were already installed in Arrakis, and I'm assuming everything was good. If you just need, like, I feel like there's a better Game of Thrones setup, and probably with more time and probably another movie, if we're being honest, that can set up the fall of the House of Atreides. Similar to, like, you know, the fall of the Starks, where there was a vendetta that was brewing. Essentially, you know, the Lannisters saw the threat in the North, even though the North really wasn't ever a threat. But because of their ego, they wanted to enact a plan that would completely disintegrate that house. And then everything comes falling back down on the Lannisters because of it. That's what I would think that I would get from the Imperium. But Christopher Walken's in a handful of scenes, and I guess we're supposed to believe that he's being manipulated by the Bene Gesserit and, you know, the Reverend Mother Imperium. And once again, I think another movie sandwiched in between Doom Part 1 and Doom Part 2 would really kind of fill in the gaps, as opposed to me having to listen to folks tell me after the movie. And yo, Christopher Walken just wasn't it. Like, him being in this movie makes me rethink this entire franchise, also because of the casting, but just like, the Emperor just doesn't work for me. And then ultimately I'm like, why do we need him at all when the Empress is kind of like, the Empress is already in the Bene Gesserit pocket. And then it just makes me kind of befuddled by the Bene Gesserit motivation altogether. Like, essentially, it's this secretive, you know, kind of like, you know, spiritual matriarchy, and they can, like, you know, kind of, you know, genetically design the ultimate being that apparently isn't going to be a woman. That speaks to the time in which the source material was written. And it makes Rebecca Ferguson's Lady Jessica, like, I didn't want to have to lean on someone else telling me, oh, well, she wanted to take things into her own hands because she deeply loved Luke, you know, Duke Leto, and she wanted to give him a boy instead of a girl. And the plan was always to give him a girl because she was supposed to be able to have a girl, and then the girl was supposed to be able to grow up and marry, you know, you know, Fade Rotha a little bit later, and they're supposed to, then the child of that is supposed to end up being the it's all really conflated, and I don't think it's told well on screen. I don't care particularly what is inferred from the books and what you hope to, like that's not good enough for me. But don't get me wrong, performance-wise, yo, Rebecca Ferguson is doing it up. Her talking to her unborn baby was interesting, but it was really cool. It made it kind of sinister, and so I didn't necessarily understand why. So I don't know really what the end-all be-all, like, outside of making sure that Paul stays alive, it felt that there was something more nefarious coming from her, and it seemed in opposition of, you know, of Charlotte Rampling's Reverend Mother, but I didn't understand necessarily why outside of her having Paul when Paul was supposed to be a Paulette. But like, if Reverend Mother was mad at her, why didn't she deal with her all those years ago? It's weird. It's really weird. Florence Pugh was in the movie. She's looking really good. Like, her costuming all throughout is great. I love hearing her. And apparently there's so much more to come from her, that character in Dune Messiah, which who knows is going to come out. It's going to come out, but it's going to be like 4 or 5 years at a minimum, right? And shout out to Lea Seydoux as Lady Margot Fenric. She's really good. The really couple of scenes that she has between her and Fade Rotha are, oh man, when they're on the Harkonnen planet, like just the use of color. I heard about this infrared camera and having it inverted, and just like that visually was so appealing. And then back to Fade Rotha, like, yo, he's dope. He's really, really good. Like, he's really, really good, and doesn't do, not by his fault, the character just doesn't get a chance to do a whole lot more. It needed like an extra like hour in this movie, or once again, another movie in between it. And even maybe half of this movie should have been also from the perspective of Fade, because it almost sets it up like Fade and Paul are these two sides of the same coin and they don't recognize it. And I think building it up even more would have made that final fight that we get between them that much more glorious. And speaking of final fights, there was something that I just kind of thought in this film would happen. Because it gets compared to so much of the other films that have this dense lore, like Lord of the Rings. And The Two Towers is my favorite Lord of the Rings movie. Helm's Deep, when I saw that in, it was either middle school or high school, like, that was phenomenal. And I thought that there was an opportunity to be able to have an equal battle scene that can rival that. And we didn't get that. The climactic final battle was anticlimactic in a little bit, because it came and it went. Like I mentioned earlier, skip. We need to get here. The editing didn't do it any favors. You know, like, not at all. But shout out to my performance. My favorite performance of the movie is Javier Bardem as Stilgar. Like, my man was all the vibes necessary to keep the movie coming along, and injected a lot more humor than I ever thought was capable inside this film, especially from what we got in the first film. But he was great. His blind devotion and belief to, you know, essentially the prophecy, and then also to Paul, it was cute, and it was like light enough to be able to keep folks definitely entertained and comedic. And I'm totally unsure where his character goes, where Paul goes, because it's a choice that's made by the end of the film. It's like, okay, so it's weird. At the end of the film, I'm being like, Paul is faced with a choice in regards to ascending to the throne to be emperor of the galaxy. He completely embraces the prophecy, which was such a quick turn. It wasn't set up well. It wasn't really earned. There was no inciting incident that made sense as to why he chose to drink the water of life at all. He just does it. And it's cool scenes of this dude walking slowly, and then all of the, you know, the Fremen kind of seeing like, oh yeah, this is our white savior. You know what I mean? And he speaks with the voice, and it's really imposing. Like, I get that. But like, what did him drinking the water of life do? Like, I needed a scene to be able to say, yo, if I don't take this, everyone will die. Contrasting, well, if I do take this, I see a vision where everyone will die. And I would love to have had that conversation with his mama, with his lady, and with Stilgar. And then something really dashly happened where he's like, I've got no choice. I didn't think that I felt that or got that on screen. And that just like, I wanted it. It was right there. Take it. It was yours. Shout out to Achilles from Troy. And it's like, by the end of the film, there's people that are kind of giving this impression that it's like a turn. It's like a heel turn almost. Like, essentially, it was Anakin turning to the dark side, but the film did not paint that picture that the choice that Paul makes at the end of Doom Part 2 was turning to the dark side. That was not conveyed effectively enough. So once again, I'm relying on people who are familiar with the book to try to fill in the gaps, and that's not successful. So I'm completely unsure what the goal is going forward. I know we're getting more, but it's years from now. And I made the mistake of saying Avatar would never happen. And I'm not going to make that mistake again. Because based off the numbers of this movie, yo, the appeal is there for Dune. But book folks are setting things up like Messiah is about to be like The Last Jedi. And do we really want more of that? So this was another incomplete film experience, but there's so much to mine from it that is fantastic. The bad guys, if we're going to call them that, they're literally hovering in orbit. They got to get dealt with. And they likely got their atomics. And Chani Dip, she's on a sandworm going somewhere. Who knows? Because I thought everybody was else. She's going to live in the desert. Once again, this is an opportunity to really breathe life into an adaptation that chooses to successfully stay away for what is good for a book, but better for a movie. So, Denis, not that you need me to tell you, really go for it. Go for what you want. Let the source material breathe life into inspiring you to take it someplace that has yet to be written. That sounds so prophetic. Make the changes whole to characters and to the plot to supersede the text. That's my ask. So while I wasn't moved in the end, and I'm still conflicted, Dune Part 2 is a cinematic achievement in sci-fi action blockbuster. The scope and ambition, almost every technical element on screen operates at a mastery level, which unfortunately makes the surface level screenplay and its characters stick out like a giant sandworm. The Kobe Toby rating for Dune Part 2 is a median high 8 out of 10. It is written and directed by Denis Villeneuve, co-written by John Spates, based on the book by Frank Herbert. It is starring Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Austin Butler, Rebecca Ferguson, Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, Florence Pugh, Dave Bautista, Lea Seydoux, Stellan Skarsgård, Charlotte Rampling, and Christopher Walken. It is now playing in theaters everywhere. Well, that'll do it for this one. Can't wait to get you the next one. I need some water. I try to keep these micropods 15 minutes or less, but like, this is a movie that was damn near 3 hours long. It's spread between two films, deserves to be talked about in as much context as I could give it. So I'm gonna get back into the swing of things. So be on the lookout. Thanks for rocking with me. When he asks you where you heard it from, tell him Kobe told me. Peace.